Welcome to How We Got There. I am your host, Mike Davis, founder of Go-To-Market Guides. I interview thought leaders and founders in the Salesforce ecosystem to help ISVs learn new things to try and mistakes to avoid. This episode of How We Got There is brought to you by Tequity Advisors, a global sell-side M&A advisory firm with core expertise in B2B enterprise cloud, SaaS, and IT services companies. They are focused on SaaS and ISVs, Salesforce, ServiceNow, SAP, Microsoft, Adobe, and the MSP clouds. Tequity has already completed 22 transactions in the Salesforce and Salesforce ISV ecosystems. Visit tequityadvisors.com, that's T-E-Q-U-I-T-Y, advisors.com, to learn how they achieve great outcomes for their clients, both in valuation and in terms. All right. I am here with Tal Frankfurt, who is the CEO and founder of Cloud for Good. Tal, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So I guess to start, share with us a bit about how you found your way into the ecosystem and what Cloud for Good does.
Yeah, so I found my way into the ecosystem in, I think, 2005. I'm originally from Israel, and at the time I was working with a small nonprofit organization that helped at-risk youth. And when I joined, they had the largest Excel spreadsheet I've ever seen. I think still to date, we had a very passionate executive director that wanted to track every conversation she's ever had for a decade. And she tracked it all in one spreadsheet with one worksheet. So we couldn't even close and open that spreadsheet. It would take forever to load. So I figured out we have to move from that, and we couldn't afford anything. And Salesforce has their 1-1-1 model where they donate 10 free licenses to nonprofits. So somebody told me that, you know, Salesforce is free, you should go play with Salesforce. And, you know, now we say that it's free, like free puppies. You still have to take them out and train them and so on. So I just logged into Salesforce and started playing with it and made tons of mistakes, had to erase my database probably 3 or 4 times. But that's kind of like how I learned Salesforce. That was about 2005, 2006. And I got, you know, super excited about the potential for not only tracking our financial return on investment, but also tracking our social return on investment. So we started implementing Salesforce for program management and tracking our case management within Salesforce, social worker case management, not IT case management. And I wanted to share my knowledge. So I started the second Salesforce user group outside of the US. There was one in London before us, and making a very long story short, people kept asking me questions, so I started charging for it, and that was the beginning of my consulting career. Moved to the US in late 2009, moved to Memphis, Tennessee, not really tech hub, and in a very interesting time, right? That was like the end of kind of like the Great Recession. I felt like I came in with everything I needed to be a Salesforce consultant. So I had the experience. I even had a certification. It was like 2009. I interviewed for 4 months and got 0 job offers. So I started Cloud for Good as a job, not as a business. I needed to figure out a way to pay rent, and I started Cloud for Good. It took me about 4 or 5 months to sign my first customer, and kind of like grew from there. So that's kind of like the short version of how I entered into the ecosystem. If you're not familiar with Cloud for Good, we're a Salesforce shop. So we're a Salesforce implementation partner that works across clouds. So literally any Salesforce cloud, we have experience, certifications, and probably a public success story about it. And we work within 2 verticals, nonprofit and higher education. We just crossed the 200 full employees. I think I have 201 full-time employees that are spread across North America right now. So we've seen a lot of growth over the years.
Congratulations. And that's great. And obviously you've carved out your niche there. And how you and I actually got introduced, although we've both been in the ecosystem for a while, was around a newer program, line of business. I'm not sure how best to describe it, but share a little bit about what you're doing around Talent for Good.
Yeah. So, you know, as we've grown over the years, you know, the one constant thing was that it was hard to find Salesforce talent. It was hard to find Salesforce talent in Memphis, Tennessee in 2010 because no one knew what it was. And it's very hard to find Salesforce talent right now. And it's a challenge that I have as an SI that is growing, but it's also a challenge that all my customers and all my partners have. So what we're seeing is a growing demand for talent, and most companies really start poaching from each other. And we were thinking, how do we enlarge the pie, right? Like, how do we bring in new talent into the ecosystem rather than, you know, poaching from others? And also, how do we bring more diversity into the ecosystem? So we launched earlier this year Talent for Good. And Talent for Good is actually now the only or the first and only Salesforce registered apprenticeship by the U.S. Department of Labor. So for those listeners overseas in Europe, apprenticeships are not that big in the U.S. So the idea is to bring new talent, hire them day one, but the first 3 months, they basically, so they're Cloud for Good, full-time employees, get all the benefits and everything, but they spend the first 3 months just learning Salesforce. They get certified, they learn consulting, they learn soft skills, they're on presentation, communication skills, and so on. And they also learn industry. And then after 3 months, we're placing them with our customers. We might place them within our projects too. And the idea is that after the 24 months is over, it's a 24-month apprenticeship, our customers can hire them directly from Cloud for Good. So there's no placement fee, there's no recruiting fee. I joke with people that, you know, I do what no one else wants to do. I bring new talents into the ecosystem and then I release them into the ecosystem. So we've seen a lot of success in the programs, kind of like we've onboarded two cohorts already this year. So it's about 30 apprentices. The diversity numbers are really high. 86% identify as BIPOC or Latinx, and it's close to 80% female. So we're also making a positive change in this community beyond bringing new talent.
Love that. And obviously ISVs listening who are looking for talent, but reach out about Talent for Good is one answer to this question. But I'm just curious, like how do you recruit diverse talent like you are in that program? Like how have you thought about strategizing to get that diverse talent pool?
Yeah, so I look at it as just like any other business problem that I have, right? So, you know, until a few, maybe a four or five years ago, we didn't really do much work in higher ed, but we really wanted to get into higher ed, so we invested in it, and we are one of the leading partners in higher ed Salesforce implementations right now, right? So the same way I look at, okay, how do I get diverse talent into my organization, right? Like it's a lot of the times you hear people talking about, hey, I can't get diverse talent because they're not applying. All right, if they're not applying, how can I hire them? But so you can solve the application issue. We had 4,500 applicants for our last cohort for 15 seats, right? So 4,500 people, I formed an advisory board, and MIT sits at the advisory board. They're not that selective. They don't pick 15 people out of 4,500. So how do we do that? We established partnerships with a handful of universities. And we looked at diverse universities, so UNT Dallas, Dallas College, Rhode Island Community College, ASU, but also Pepperdine and others. And then we also established partnership with nonprofit organizations like Co-op or PathStream or PepUpTech, right, that can basically help us spread the word and feed us with that talent. So that's how we're addressing it.
Nice. Be intentional, run a program around like where to look. That makes a lot of sense. And looking on your website, you have over 20 ISV partners that are listed on there. I guess when you think about partnering with ISVs, what are some of the best partner characteristics that you look for, both good and or bad? I mean, folks are very eager to find the right SIs to partner with and help win together. So I guess, what do you look for in a good ISV partner?
Yeah, so I'd say I look for three things, right? So if I look at, let's just take forms as an example, right? So, you know, from a form functionality, can they address anything that I want to put on a public form out there, right? I don't know, dependency between the questions or whatever my client is going to want from a form tool. Then the second thing is, how is their Salesforce integration built, right? Like, can you map any custom form field question to custom field in Salesforce? You know, what's the logic that is built in that integration? So first thing was, you know, your functionality that the customer is looking for. The second thing is the Salesforce integration is critical. And then the third thing, which is the most important for us, is support, right? And there is the customer support, which is super important. For me, it's more important is the partner support, right? If I bring you in, like that, I kind of like put my reputation on the line saying, hey, you should go work with this ISV, or, you know, we'll give them three options. But right, my name is at stake if you all don't deliver. But it's okay to have problems. Every company has issues, right? The question is like, what happens when there is an issue? And when there is an issue, I want to be able to shine as an SI, right? I want to be able to escalate it to the right people. I don't want to submit a form online. I want my consultants to have direct access to the ISV. That's, I think, where partnerships are really successful. At the end of the day, and I think that kind of like I always tell that, I give that as an advice to ISVs, my sales team is normally not the one that's going to bring the ISV, right? So it's not the sales team that you need to convince. It's the consultants that are working in the org, in the Salesforce org. Those are the ones that are likely going to recommend the ISV. And what they care about is what happens when there is a problem, how complicated is integration, and how kind of like standard is the integration? Like, are you using standard Salesforce object? Are you reinventing opportunities? So I'd say those are the key things for me when we're evaluating ISVs.
One thing you said there that was interesting that might be counterintuitive to some folks listening is not targeting the salespeople at an SI to enable them, but more on the consultant side. Can you double click a little bit into that and just the rationale why and maybe a little bit around how best to enable consultants as well? Because I'd imagine you don't want your team getting reached out to by 50 different ISVs. So like, I guess what kind of makes sense from an approach standpoint too?
Yeah, so on the consultant side, right, if you think about it, when I write an SOW, and let's take a different type, like I want to recommend a mail merge. So I have a mail merge in probably every SOW I have. So when I talk with a customer, I'm not going to say, hey, go with mail merge A or mail merge B, because in my business, typing before diagnosing the problem is a malpractice, right? I'm not going to recommend the tool before I have a good understanding of what the customer needs are. And yes, there are differences between ISVs. They're not doing, even on a mail merge, they're not exactly the same. So I want to spend some time with that customer before I say yes, and you should go with X and not Y. And the person that is spending the time and that's going to end up recommending it is the consultant. It's not the salesperson that closed the deal. It's the person implementing the solution. It's the person that has a daily contact with the client. So, you know, especially the more and more, like if you think of the bigger and more technical the solution is, probably you need to go talk with the more and more technical consultants, right? If it's a simple, something that, you know, you just plug and play, yeah, maybe the salesperson can do it. But most of the solutions, the ISVs that we're implementing require some technical skills. And then it's really your consultant is your influencer, not the AE or the salesperson as your influencer. And our, you know, we're tracking referrals to ISVs as good as we can. You know, there's some ISVs where we've crossed 200 referrals just since we start tracking it in the last 4 or 5 years. So it's definitely fruitful to maintain those consultant connections. And I think your second question there was, okay, so how do you reach out? The best way to explore a partnership, I don't know, it's a chicken and egg thing, is when you have a joint client, right? So if we're already working in a deal and the customer is happy, that's an easy way to get in and say, hey, we have a partner alliances organization within Cloud for Good. They are your right person, not me. By the way, I get a lot of these inquiries. I am not the one that is going to recommend something to a client or to a consultant. Then what we recommend, once you are in, right, you've done one project, it went well, consultant has a positive experience, we do enablement. So just like with when I think about my relationship with Salesforce and Salesforce AE, I need to stay top of mind. At the end of the day, they're bringing me in because they remember that just had a conversation with me that day or that week. And next week, they might forget about us. I'm semi-joking here. So we do constant enablement with our consultants. So we want to get technical and want to get, they need to see your application. And, you know, we do a monthly enablement for everyone at Cloud for Good, but that's what I would do after, right? It's not the referral fees that are going to bring you the next customer from my experience.
So much goodness there. I think some learnings for ISVs in what you shared is starting with a mutual customer. And so an action item for ISVs that Cloud for Good is doing, but ISVs should as well, is start asking who the SI is in all of your customer accounts and start to track that in Salesforce to look for which SIs are you have a good overlap with. So you have Absolutely. A reason to reach out. And then those enablement sessions, those are pretty consistent across the ecosystem, both on the Salesforce account teams and SEs, but also at SIs. And so put together a thoughtful, I normally tell people, 30-minute enablement session with a demo and a little bit of how to engage, how to get that key support that you talked about. But yeah, there's a lot of goodness that you just shared. So thanks for that.
And come prepared to these enablement sessions, right? The consultants are technical. They're going to ask technical questions. The slide's going to take you the first 5 minutes, but after that, they want to see, right? They want to touch it. They want to see what does it look like? What does the Salesforce integration look like? How much, right? What's going on in their head is, okay, how much work, what do I need to do to set it up? How complicated is that going to be? Are they working, you know, in the nonprofit education? Is it aligned with nonprofit success back or education data model, right? Or whatever, financial services data model. So like, keep that in mind that you're presenting to a relatively technical team and they're going to have technical questions and you should be prepared with that. I've gone through so many enablements where it's just slides and it doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah, just showing up with slides is going to be a bad time. Not bringing a sales engineer who can answer some of those questions is going to be a bad time. And I guess the last question on ISVs, and please don't name names. You might have just introduced one thing, but what's something an ISV does that you'd never want to work with them again after?
For us, so, you know, we had one example where the customer was a month or so behind, not more than a month, not more than 2 months. And they turned off, the ISV turned off the customer's access to the app. That for me is a big nap, right? Like that, I get it. You need to get paid, but just without telling us, without telling the customer, we logged in and the app didn't exist anymore. And I asked what happened. It's like, oh, they were a month behind. So we turned it off. That was traumatic, I would say, for us and for the customer. And we will not work with them again, right? Like the other thing is the customer has a problem. And actually, we're having that right now with a pretty big app out there, right? And there is no one that it is available to answer a question, right? And it's a customer, it's their customer, and I'm just trying to help. And no one is willing to jump in and on a call with the customer. They're just messaging through us. And I'm not a messenger for the ISV. So, you know, if I can get a support person on the phone, and that can also join with a customer, I will not bring them again.
Good lessons learned there. And for your business as an SI, what's your top producing lead source? Like, where do you find your business? Just as ISVs are trying to look for win-wins while aligning with SIs.
Yeah, so for us, a lot of it is Salesforce. So Salesforce is probably, from a net new logos, Salesforce is the one. Like, Salesforce account executives are the ones that are referring to us. If you think about kind of like account executive, a Salesforce in general is very account executive centric, right? The AEs in many times hold a relationship with that customer. So yes, you should have a relationship with the RVP or the AVP, but the higher you go within Salesforce, the less impact they're going to have on the actual revenue and the actual referral. At the end of the day, the person that's going to bring you in is the account executive at Salesforce, or the cloud, the consultant at Cloud for Good, not the CEO, not the VP, not the sales team. So for us, it's a lot of Salesforce relationships. We spend a lot of time on that, and a lot of account, let's say my 60% of my revenue is actually with existing clients that are looking to do something else with Salesforce. So they've done fundraising, next they want to do marketing. After that, maybe it's program. After that, it's, you know, back office integration. Then we offer managed services. So that's kind of like the two biggest sources of new revenue for us.
Excellent. And just generally speaking, what are you most proud of as you've built Cloud for Good?
So pride and being proud of what we do is actually when I do onboarding with new employees, I tell them that they should be proud of everything that they're doing, right? It's like delivering excellence means that I am proud of, you know, this interview that we're doing right now or a presentation that we've had, right? So like I want to wake up in the morning and say that I'm proud of every employee that works at Cloud for Good or every solution that we developed. So in general, we talk a lot at Cloud for Good about being proud of the work that we do. But, you know, if I have to kind of like pick one thing and kind of like the biggest thing that I'm proud of is that, you know, we were able to build, you know, a pretty large SI, right? Like there are not a lot of SIs that have crossed the 200 full employees in North America and are still growing. And we're able to do that while also doing good in the world, while also making really big impact in our communities, impact in our nonprofit and education, and also impact from a talent point of view. So I'm proud that we're able to reach that kind of like the scale while also focusing on the industries that we're focusing on.
Nice. And what's been your biggest mistake along the way, or what's been a mistake along the way that you've made?
Geez, I make tons of mistakes.
You and I both.
you have to make mistakes in order. So learning is another core value for us. And you can't learn if you keep doing the same thing over and over. And you can't, right? Like, so you have to try something different. And when you constantly try something different, you're going to make mistakes. We've tried to enter like a financial application implementation market. And, you know, we had to back off that because the type of buyers are completely different than the buyers that we used to sell. I used to sell, like, right, when we talk with our customers, I sell imagination of like, hey, look at where we can take you. We can create new value. When I talk with controllers, they want to make sure they can do the exact same reports that they're doing right now in their new system. So not exactly the type of customer that I'm used to sell to. We tried to expand to Europe. We opened an office in the Netherlands and then in Germany and then in Ireland. And then we closed Ireland, Germany, and the Netherlands because we just didn't know how to go after talent there and have to go after customers there. So we make mistakes all the time. As a rule at Cloud for Good, by the way, we share our mistakes. So it's really bad that you're making a mistake and you make the same mistake again. I think that it's even worse from an organization point of view when you make a mistake and someone else is going to make the same mistake again. So we try to kind of like fight that thing that I call like people tend to hoard their mistakes, right? You don't want to tell anyone that you made a mistake because it's going to come up in your annual review or your bonus, or maybe your board's going to hear about it and who knows what's going to happen. So we make a big effort to encourage people to share their mistakes. We, as a leadership team, we review every quarter two projects that, you know, didn't go well and two projects that went well. And we all are able to have a conversation without pointing fingers about what we did wrong and how we can do better next time and what learning. So I'm big on mistakes, as you can see. I'm very passionate about making mistakes.
Well, and I want to double click on one of those that you mentioned, the expansion one, because I speak with a lot of ISVs in the US and a lot of ISVs in EMEA. And the grass is always greener on the other side. Everybody is interested in crossing the ocean and get tapping into it, because rough math, Salesforce, about 70% of their revenue is North America, about 20% is EMEA, and about 10% is APAC. And so when you're talking about billions of dollars of install base, like, it's of interest. I guess for folks that are thinking about setting up that remote office, any sort of things to avoid or learnings from that other than having to fold up?
Folding, that was a good thing. I've learned a lot about German labor laws, than probably more than I should know. I think it's very different than opening, going and trying after, like, you know, expanding from the US to Europe or, you know, Latin America or wherever, than, you know, expanding from Europe to the US. Right. US has one language, has one currency. Labor laws can be a little different, but overall there is some common denominator around it, right? You go to Europe, different languages, different countries, different currencies. There is a lot of commonality too. You know, your market is much smaller than coming to the US. The potential in the US is just massive. So, you know, I would definitely encourage EMEA Vs to kind of like think about expanding to the US market. It's huge. But keep in mind, you need to have local representation. You have to figure out your support hours. We are not, you know, there are a lot of Vs in Australia. You know, you have to figure out when, if I have a problem, what day am I going to call you, right? Like, Australia time zones are like a day and a half ahead or behind, like, right? Like, it's right. So you have to think about how you're going to provide support in a different continent. How you're going to, right? How you're going to support the language? How you're going to support the currency? So, you know, that. I think it's definitely worth it. Just have to do a lot of thinking.
Awesome. Well, we're going to wrap up here with the final three questions, rapid fire answers. Ready to go?
Yes.
All right. Who is one person or company in the ecosystem that you track or follow?
Yeah, I'm struggling with this right now because for years I've always wanted to be like a Stadia or Theorius and Aperio and, you know, and Traction, and everybody's been acquired and disappeared. So I've, since the acquisition of Traction, I'm struggling a little bit about kind of like, who do I follow? But, you know, I think Slalom is doing a good job out there, so definitely follow them.
Nice. And what would you, way back when, what would you tell yourself day one of working in the ecosystem?
I would not change. Again, going to the failures and learnings, I think I've learned a lot from a lot of the mistakes, but putting yourself out there in the ecosystem while also thinking about perception. I think people tend to kind of like overshare in our ecosystem sometimes, and just think about kind of like, you know, I like to think, I want to sell $1 million project to a customer. Are they going to buy that from me if I say X, Y, Z? So just think about kind of like when you put yourself out there and you share in the community, how you're going to be perceived. But definitely for me, the intro to the ecosystem was a lot about answering questions on the job boards, on the Salesforce boards, right? That I became Salesforce MVP in 2009. And a lot of it was just answering people's questions. So I encourage people to do that.
Nice. And lastly, what gives you energy in your personal life?
My kids.
What age are the kiddos?
That was the easy one. I gave you like one answer. I have a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old. You know, two girls, and they're awesome.
Nice. That's awesome. Tal, thank you so much for joining and sharing the SI's perspective. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening, and I hope you learned something from today's episode of How We Got There. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe on iTunes and leave a review. I'll see you here next time.